This is Rob Jacobson with the Tuesday, March 17, 2026 edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. We'll start the reading this morning with the headline article on page one, entitled Wrigley Legacy, Love for Parade. Daughter follows late father's footsteps, organizing event. Jim Wrigley's family didn't know 2025 would be the final St. Patrick's Day parade under the patriarch's guidance, but he had talked about retiring, it said his son, Connor Wrigley. With the consent of his family, including his son, Jim Wrigley had discussed the possibility of transferring the parade power to his daughter, Kate Pletch. "Oh yeah, Kate can do it," Connor Wrigley said at the time. "She's a lot better at handling that kind of stuff. I'm more go with the flow." Jim Wrigley passed away in January, about the time he would have been thinking about the parade, his daughter said. "I haven't had a lot of time to think about it, so I'm just following in his footsteps this year." Jim Wrigley organized the St. Patrick's Day Parade for 25 years, and I've been involved in some way or another, Pletch said. "This is my first year, I'd say, doing it on my own, but we have family members who've been volunteering all along, too. The family, including cousins, nieces, nephews, and friends, kept many traditions during Saturday's annual parade. And it was very emotional," Connor Wrigley said, who carried the Irish flag at the beginning of the parade, a job he had done for years. "He always had us do it, and he'd follow behind us. Friends are often as close as family, so the family relied on close friends Jerry and Kim Schluter, who traveled from Tennessee to help wherever they were needed. We drove 9 hours to help Kate with the parade, and also to be here for them," Jerry Schluter said. "We knew this was going to be hard for them, and hard for us, too. The Schluters drove the convertible that carried the Grand Marshal, Jim's widow, Vicky, through this year's parade. And I drove Jim last year when he was running for city council," Jerry Schluter said. "Although this year's parade was her first as the lead organizer, Pletch knows how to handle the clipboard filled with all the important parade information. I've watched my dad do the same thing," she said. Pletch kept most of the details and organization the same, but she used social media more than her father. "He wasn't a big Facebook user," she said, "so I've been trying to figure out how to reach out to people that way." In the process of organizing the parade, Pletch learned her father was popular among many in the community. "He talked to a lot of people," she said, "and I know now why he knew so many people." Pletch was the connection with organizations, businesses, and agencies for this year's parade, allowing her to build her own partnerships. "It's really a cool way to learn about different businesses and groups in the community," she said. "That's the goal, to get everyone out on the streets to throw candy and stuff, but also to get your name out there." The love for the parade was passed down to Pletch and her brother. "It was kind of a whole season for him being Irish," Pletch said, "and it is a way to feel closer to him." Although Jim Wrigley may be gone, his presence at the St. Patrick's Day parade was still felt, his family said. "I feel close to my loved ones when I'm doing things that remind me of him," Pletch said. "I think it was his favorite holiday, more so than Christmas." Pletch said she believes her father would have been proud that she stepped into his parade shoes. "It was kind of the plan that when he was ready to step down, I would take over, along with one of my cousins," she said. According to a 2022 Herald and Review interview with Jim Wrigley, Decatur's parade history goes back approximately 40 years and has become a celebration of the close of winter and the start of spring, overlaid with a healthy dose of Irish heritage. He pointed out the parade is meant to remember the good things of life and acknowledge a proud past that contributed to the start in the new world. "The Irish came from a place that was in bad shape, hard times, and we came over here and just started kind of rebuilding ourselves," Wrigley said during the interview. "And those people then said, you know what? Here is a crazy day in the middle of March. Might be snowing, might be raining, but let's walk down the street and have a party." Next, also a front page article, primary election day is here. Voters to pick party nominees in federal, state, and local races. It's primary election day in Illinois. Voters will decide who will find a place on the November 3 ballot for a host of federal, state, and county offices, as well as a few ballot questions. Polls are open from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. Voters can find more information about voting and election day on the county website, MaconCounty.Illinois.gov. On the local level, Macon County voters will decide who will represent the Republican Party for county clerk and sheriff, and Democrats will decide who will represent their party in District 1 on the Macon County Board. Sheriff Jim Root is being challenged by Shane Beck, a deputy in his department. Beck is running as a write-in candidate after he was removed from the ballot for not numbering the pages on his nominating petitions. The race for clerk features Kurt Younghouse and Marsha Webb. The winner will go on to face Democrat Brian Smith. Incumbent Josh Tanner isn't seeking re-election. For County Board District 1, incumbent Vivian Goodman is being challenged by Stephanie King. Elsewhere in the area, voters in the Shelbyville School District will decide if $40 million in bonds will be issued to fund the construction of a new grade school to serve grades pre-K through fourth grades. Shelby County voters will decide the Republican candidate for clerk, treasurer, and sheriff. Sullivan voters are being asked if the city should adopt a managerial form of government, replacing the existing commission form of government. Moultrie County voters will decide who will be the Republican candidate for clerk and sheriff. Voters across the region will determine which candidates will go on to represent each party in the races for the 13th and 15th congressional district seats. The 15th is a sprawling district that covers most of the rural areas and small towns of central Illinois, stretching from the Missouri and Iowa borders all the way to the Indiana state line. Incumbent Republican Mary Miller is being challenged by Judy Bowlby and Ryan Tebrug. There are four Democrats seeking the nomination: Jennifer Todd, Randy Raley, Paul Davis, and Kyle Nudo. In the 13th District, incumbent Democrat Nikki Budzinski is being challenged by Dylan Blaha. The Republican ballot features Jeff Wilson and Joshua Lloyd. There also is a contested race for the 107th State House District. Incumbent Republican Brad Halbrook is being challenged by John Haug. Statewide, there are a host of candidates from both parties seeking to replace Dick Durbin in the U.S. Senate. There is a full slate of Republican candidates seeking to challenge J.B. Pritzker for governor, and there's also a contested race for Secretary of State on the Republican ticket, and a race for comptroller on the Democratic ticket. The other front page article on today's paper, entitled "Israel Steps Up Campaign in Lebanon." This is an Associated Press article out of Beirut, Lebanon. The war in the Middle East raged on multiple fronts on Monday as the U.S. and Israel pummeled military targets in Iran's capital. Israel stepped up its campaign against Iran-backed militants in Lebanon, and Iran retaliated with a drone strike that temporarily shut down Dubai's airport, a critical hub for travelers. Fears of a global energy crisis persisted even as a small number of ships passed through the Strait of Hormuz, a vital waterway through which a fifth of the world's oil is usually transported. Iranian strikes on commercial ships in and around the strait, and even just the threat of those attacks, slowed shipping there to a trickle. That dramatically increased the price of oil and put pressure on Washington to do something to ease the pain for consumers and the global economy. Crude, the international standard, remained over $100 a barrel on Monday. U.S. President Donald Trump said he demanded that about seven countries send warships to keep the Strait of Hormuz open, but his appeals brought no commitments. Two Indian-flagged ships and a Pakistani-flagged ship crossed the strait this weekend, according to authorities and a marine tracking website. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said of the strait, "From our perspective, it is open, just not for the United States, Israel, and its allies. on social media. Argaci also rejected as delusional claims that Iran wants a negotiated end to the war. He said it seeks neither truce nor talks. Since the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran more than 2 weeks ago, Tehran regularly fired drones and missiles at Israel, American bases in the region, and Gulf Arab countries' energy infrastructure. The virtual shutdown of the Strait of Hormuz is battering the world economy, driving up energy and fertilizer prices, threatening food shortages in poor countries, destabilizing fragile states, and complicating efforts by central banks to drive down prices for consumers. Trump said Sunday he wants to police the strait to make it safe for shipping. Republicans are increasingly concerned that rising prices for American consumers will hurt them in elections this fall. Trump did not identify the countries he said he asked to help with those efforts, but he said he won't forget the countries that decline. He has previously appealed to China, France, Japan, South Korea, and Britain. Whether we get support or not, I can say this, and I said to them, we will remember, Trump said. Admiral Brad Cooper, the top U.S. military commander in the Middle East, said in a video on social media that American forces are zeroing in on Iran's threats to freighters carrying oil and natural gas through the narrow strait between the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean. Europeans have been critical of the U.S. and Israel for failing to provide clarity on their objectives in the war. Ahead of a meeting in Brussels, the European Union's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, said the bloc's foreign ministers would discuss possibly extending a naval mission that protects ships in the Red Sea to the Strait of Hormuz without giving any details. Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani told reporters in Brussels that his country favors strengthening anti-piracy and defensive missions in the Red Sea, but said he didn't believe in expanding their roles to the Strait of Hormuz. Prime Minister Keir Starmer of Britain, which is not an EU member, told reporters that Britain and allies were working on a plan to reopen the strait. Starmer said Britain might deploy mine-hunting UK drones already in the region, but insisted it will not be drawn into the wider war. He suggested the UK is unlikely to dispatch a warship. Japan and Australia both said Monday that they were not asked to help protect the strait and had no plans to do so. Massive explosions were heard in Beirut as Israel launched new attacks on the Lebanese capital before dawn, saying it was striking infrastructure related to the Iran-linked Hezbollah militia group. Hezbollah began firing rockets into northern Israel after the U.S.-Israeli attack of Iran on February 28. The Israeli army issued evacuation orders for many neighborhoods in Beirut, as well as southern Lebanon. Israel's strikes displaced more than 800,000 Lebanese from large swaths of the country's southern region and its capital's southern suburbs, and Israel, about 850 people in Lebanon. Some Israeli troops pushed into southern Lebanon, and there are fears that Israel is preparing a large-scale invasion. In southern Lebanon, Israeli airstrikes killed 7 people, according to authorities and news reports. Not long after the Israeli military announced it launched new strikes on Tehran, targeting infrastructure, explosions were heard in the Iranian capital and outlying areas. More details were not immediately available, with information coming out of Iran severely limited by internet outages, round-the-clock airstrikes, and tight restrictions on journalists. More than 1,300 people were killed in Iran so far, according to the Iranian Red Crescent. Israel carried out some 7,600 strikes on Iran so far, knocking out 85% of its air defenses and 70% of Iran's missile launchers, military spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Nadiv Shoshani told reporters Monday. But Shoshani said Israel still has thousands of targets to hit and would continue attacks for as long as needed. In Israel, Iranian missile fire has killed 12 people. At least 13 U.S. military members have also been killed. Moving back to state news, an article entitled "Outside Spending Surges in Illinois Primary Races." Independent campaign expenditures have skyrocketed this year in state legislative races. All of these numbers were current as of 4:20 p.m. Friday, March 13, when I finished writing this column. Independent expenditure committees are not allowed to coordinate their spending with candidates, ergo the independent label. As with the federal level, they are also not limited in how much they can spend on any state or local races. Total spending, including the race for the open state comptroller position, was at $5.5 million for the calendar year. 2 years ago, independent expenditures in legislative primaries totaled a bit over $500,000, and half of that was because the Illinois Education Association was almost fully funding a couple of Republicans running against far-right Illinois Freedom Caucus members. We had no statewide races here in 2022. During the first primary season, after the decennial redistricting 4 years ago, the IEs totaled about $2 million in legislative races when tons of open seats existed. The spending back then was dominated by INCS Action, a pro-charter schools IE committee, with large contributions from the founding family of Walmart. An additional $500,000 or so was spent by a Ken Griffin-backed IE committee on two down-ballot statewide primary races, Attorney General and Secretary of State, and the beneficiaries of that spending both lost, Steve Kim and John Millhiser. In other words, the current spending is without precedent. The DraftKings-funded American Future Committee has alone reported spending $2.6 million on 10 state legislative races. Often, legislative campaign mail programs switch to all positive during the final week of the campaign, but online sports betting company was still churning out negative mail as I wrote this. None of the independent expenditure committees that we tracked had yet to attack an incumbent as of this writing. They were either defending those already in office or using positive messaging and also some negative messaging to try and pick someone who was running for a vacant seat. The online sports betting company doesn't care for Illinois' high taxes, so they apparently decided to do something about it, spending $577,000 to boost Senator Emile Jones III, Democrat of Chicago, and attack his Democratic opponent, Ahmad Karar. It has reported spending $468,000 backing its former State House lobbyist Adam Braun in the 13th House District and whacking one of his well-funded challengers, James O'Brien. The gaming company's committee has also spent $364,000 supporting Representative Jaime Andrade, Democrat of Chicago, and opposing his progressive opponent, Miguel Alvelo Rivera. It has plunked down $308,000 to support Chantel Franklin in an open house seat contest on the city's west side, $291,000 supporting Aja Kearney in the 34th House District race, and $252,000 supporting Saba Haider and attacking Jared Ploeger in the 84th House District. Ploeger is getting most of his direct contributions from teachers' unions, while Haider is heavily backed by trade unions. The Common Ground Collective Independent Expenditure Committee is fronted by Chicago billionaire Michael Sachs. It had $1.7 million, of which $1.35 million went to Representative Margaret Croak, who is running for state comptroller against three other Democrats. The incumbent, Susana Mendoza, isn't running again. The IE committee's legislative focus is almost entirely on Representative Andrade's Northwest side race. It had spent $346,000 supporting him and opposing Miguel Alvelo Rivera, mainly over his failure to vote in a couple of elections and for criticizing the Democratic Party. Facebook parent company Meta has a committee named Making Our Tomorrow, which had spent $561,000, mostly on two races. The above-mentioned Adam Braun has benefited from $172,000 in Meta spending, and Paul Kendrick in the crowded 12th House District race received $230,000 in independent expenditures. Other groups spending money are the pro-charter school INCS Action, $240,000, the Illinois Realtors, $202,000, and Americans for Prosperity Illinois, which put $150,000 into Republican primary races. Some wonder whether this primary race spending is just a test, and whether gigantic companies like DraftKings and Meta will eventually unleash on incumbents during future contests. Meta has pledged to stay positive, but that could change. It's just too early to tell what sort of impact this legislative campaign spending will have on the State House. We won't really know until after the votes are counted. But legislators generally loathe having to deal with primary opponents. Add in the possibility that some rando is adopted by a billionaire or a special interest, and that loathing could turn to fear. Moving on to an article about St. Patrick's Day entitled Green Day, How Celebrating Ireland's Patron Saint Became an American Tradition Too. If it's March and it's green, it must be St. Patrick's Day. The day honoring the patron saint of Ireland is a global celebration of Irish heritage, and nowhere is that more so than in the United States, where parades take place in cities around the country, and all kinds of foods and drinks are given an emerald hue. In fact, it was among Irish American communities that the day became the celebration it is, from its roots as a more solemn day with a religious observance in Ireland. But even in America, it was about more than a chance to dye a river green, looking at you, Chicago, or just bust out a favorite piece of green clothing. It was about putting down roots and claiming a piece of the country's calendar. Patrick was not really Irish, according to experts. Born in the late 4th century, he was captured as an adolescent and ended up enslaved in Ireland. He escaped to another part of Europe, where he was trained as a priest and returned to Ireland in the 5th century to promote the spread of Christianity. Several centuries later, he was made a saint by the Catholic Church, and like other saints, had a day dedicated to him, which was March 17. He became Ireland's patron saint, and even when religious strife broke out between Catholics and Protestants, was claimed by both, says Mike Cronin, historian and academic director of Boston College Dublin. How did an Irish Saints Day become an American thing? The short answer is that Irish people came to America and brought their culture with them. St. Patrick's Day observances date back to before the founding of the U.S. in places like Boston and New York City. The first parade was held in Manhattan on 1762. While the day was marked with more of a religious framing and solemnity in Ireland until well into the 20th century, in America, it became the cultural and boisterous celebration it is today, marked by plenty of people without a trace of Irish heritage. It was because people in Ireland started seeing how the day was marked in the U.S. that it became more of a festival in the country of its origin, rather than strictly a religious observance, Cronin said, pointing to the parades, parties, and other festivities that are held. Oh, and by the way, for those who like to shorten names, use St. Paddy's Day. Not St. Patty's Day. Paddy is a nickname for Padraig, P-A-D-R-A-I-G, which is the Irish spelling of Patrick. Why is it such a big deal? Holidays aren't simply days to watch bands go by or wear a specific outfit or costume. Being able to mark a holiday and have others mark it is a way of putting down roots, showing that you've made it in American culture, says Lee Schmidt, professor in the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University. You've made your claim on that American calendar in American civic life by having these holidays widely recognized. The spread of St. Patrick's Day celebrations in the U.S. was a way for Irish immigrant communities, who in the 1800s faced discrimination and opposition, to stake that ground, he says. It's a kind of immigrant Irish way of combating nativist antagonism against them. A popular sight around the holiday is the shamrock, or three-leaf clover, linked to Ireland and St. Patrick. The lucky ones, though, come across something that's harder to find, a four-leaf clover. That's because it takes a recessive trait or traits in the clover's genetics for there to be more than the normal three leaves, says Vincent Panetti, who has been fascinated by the plants since high school. Four-leaf clovers are real, but they are rare, he says. That doesn't mean they can't be found. People just have to keep their eyes open and get really good at noticing patterns and breaks in the patterns. And they just start jumping out at you, he says. Katie Glarum finds them. She says it's not unheard of for her to be out in a park and see one. She usually scoops it up and often gives it to someone else to a positive response. If it happened every day, then I probably would be less excited about it, she says. But yeah, when it happens, it is exciting. Shifting gears and moving on to an article in sports entitled Illini Women Back in NCAA Tournament. All of this is about giving them that opportunity. Article out of Champaign. 3 years ago, the Illinois women's basketball team's NCAA tournament selection felt like excitement mixed with disappointment. Yes, the Illini were back in the NCAA tournament for the first time in two decades, but Illinois was relegated to a play-in game. The Illini lost to Mississippi State in a first-four matchup as a number 11 seed. Last year, that same veteran group of Illini players got to celebrate another NCAA tournament berth. It was more of a triumphant moment. That was followed by Illinois, a number 8 seed, winning its first NCAA tournament game in 25 years before losing to top seed Texas in the second round. This March was different again, because this time it's basically a completely different group of players who will be dancing in March Madness again. Illinois is back in the NCAA tournament for the third time in 4 years under coach Shauna Green, and playing in March Madness in back-to-back seasons for the first time since making four consecutive trips from 1996 through 2000. And yet, Green is doing so with a roster that opened the 2025-26 season 4 months ago with 8 newcomers and is the third youngest Power Conference roster nationally. This is something you never take for granted, to be able to hear our name called 2 consecutive years here at Illinois. And it's just an amazing thing, an amazing feeling, Green said Sunday night after the Illini landed a number 7 seed ahead of a first-round NCAA tournament matchup with number 10 seed Colorado at 8:30 p.m. on Saturday at Memorial Gymnasium on the Vanderbilt campus in Nashville, Tennessee. I don't know a lot of people that thought we might be here. Losing 80% of our roster, our scoring, and having a lot of young guys, I'm just so proud of these guys. The build-up to Selection Sunday, a 9-day wait in Illinois' case after a quarterfinal loss at the Big Ten tournament to Iowa on March 6, didn't have as many nervous moments for Green as year one did, with the Illini actually an NCAA tournament bubble team in 2023, as it turned out. Green felt confident about the resume her Illinois team had built this year. In fact, the fourth-year Illini coach said the win against Michigan State in the Big Ten tournament's second round, a third quad one win for Illinois, likely solidified her team as a number 7 seed. Preparing for the NCAA tournament started after the Illini returned from Indianapolis. Green gave her team 2 days off before Illinois focused on themselves with a near full week of work at Ubben Basketball Complex, designed to get Illinois ready for what it might face in March Madness. A confident Illini team is heading to Nashville after faring well in the winner go home scenario of a Big Ten tournament, and is facing those same prospects again later this week. We'll be back with part two of today's reading in a moment.